So here's to all of the good thinkers, and here's to the lonely drinker. But don't you know, let this moment pass.
Hello, folks. My name is Jason Spies, and I'm an award-winning multimedia journalist and then the host of the Crude Life Media Network and podcast. Thank you, folks, for tuning in to The Crude Life, a place for expert interviews, full-length features, and specialty programs. And it is all thanks to our fine sponsors. Be loyal to our sponsors. They keep the program free and literally keep our lights on.
So here's to watching the clocks of our grandfathers, and here's to stopping and picking flowers, and here's to not letting this moment pass you by.
I'm Erin Schrody. I'm a citizen activist and a journalist, and co-founder of Turning Green, a nonprofit organization.
So before we talk about your experience out in the Bakken oil field, talk about your organization, either from the media side or the journalist side, or also the activism side, or is it both?
Well, for me, it's a little bit of everything. We started Turning Green almost 12 years ago, working with high school and college students around environmental education and advocacy. And for me, it began because my hometown, Marin County, where I was born and raised, had the highest breast, prostate, and melanoma cancer rates in the world. And no one knew why. And in one of the most affluent counties on Earth, we were told there wasn't enough money to do the testing. So I started delving into water, into demographics, into lifestyle choices, into the bioaccumulation of toxins. So for me, this through line of public health, of resources, of environmentalism has been, I mean, we started that when I was 13 years old, and I have gotten a chance to work on a number of issues, environmental and social justice, and lobbying for legislative change, as well as boots on the ground activism around waste, around water, around green chemistry, around food safety, and so for me to hear about what's happening in Standing Rock, for months, I've been following it mostly from a pipeline, you know, risk of leak or rupture point of view. We've had 3,300 leaks or ruptures on shore in the United States between 2010 and 2015 alone. This year, there have been over 270 in 2016. And so you see these startling statistics, and the fact that this originally was supposed to go through a predominantly white area of Bismarck and has now been rerouted to skirt the land, the sacred land, the burial site of Standing Rock, of this Native American nation, this reservation. And there's just despicable human rights violations happening. It's a travesty. There's so many fights that are all converging in this one place around, you know, the transport of crude oil, around the unearthing of burial sites, around illegal land seizure, around, you know, destruction of sacred objects, prayer pipes, feathers. It's not just about one pipeline or one nation. It's to protect the watershed for generations to come of 17 million people right now, from the Dakotas all the way to the Gulf.
So a couple questions here. I was going to ask you about your interactions with some officials and that sort of thing, but first I wanted to find out where were you at, or were you in Marin County when you heard about this? What brought you to North Dakota in terms of what was the straw that broke the camel's back? Because I assume you're not living in from North Dakota at this current point. You came out to the protest, right?
I live in Marin County. And I was actually doing Get Out the Vote work in Ohio last week. And like I said, I've been following it, but I've been pretty much laser-focused on the election. I myself ran for Congress earlier this year in California, and I've been doing a lot of coverage. I've been doing election coverage for ABC News. I've been writing for Glamour and for Cosmo, really working on getting out the vote with a millennial demographic specifically and a female demo. And so for me, I was in Ohio, and I saw this post on social media, a call from the Standing Rock Dakota Lakota Nation to come, that they needed numbers, masses, solidarity. And I literally left. I literally was in Standing Rock 2 days later.
So you're out in Standing Rock. What's your first impressions out there when you get out there? I mean, is this like something you imagined, or is it like the media was reporting? Or before we get to your incident, just what was your first impressions out there?
So I went with a friend of mine, a filmmaker named Josh Fox, and Josh and I on Sunday night, I guess, so just a little more than a week ago, interviewed these two people, Fleurice and Mikasi. And Fleurice is a 34-year-old woman from Standing Rock, Native. And that was absolutely unbelievable, the truest of the words, to hear from her lips the experiences of being arrested, ripped out of prayer circle, thrown into dog kennels, seeing people beaten, seeing elders taken from their sweat lodges, being TPs opened with the ends of assault rifles, just the violence against the peaceful, prayerful people. So before I even set foot on the land, to hear from these two people firsthand experiences that were so different than that which I've been reading in the media. I do follow, you know, environmental media, indigenous media, niche media that was giving it some attention. But I was shocked. So when we arrived to see this camp, I mean, it was really beautiful. The energy there, you come in and there's the tribes, flags, over 300 different nations that have come to represent, not just the 300 flags, from tribal nations, from other countries, from communities, the solidarity there in this camp, people who have come to stand with our Native brothers and sisters. And we didn't know exactly what was going to happen, but we felt called to be there. We were humbled to be able to share the stories. Josh did a video about Fleurice, which has now peaked over 23 million views, which is just an amazing portrait of this woman. I wrote a profile on her for Glamour magazine. And so we had these near dear friends who introduced us, and a number of other people, organizers, activists that were had been on the ground there for months, Native and non-Native. And we immediately felt so welcomed, you know, to be able to tell these stories with integrity, to be able to amplify for maximum attention and action is a gift, but, you know, a responsibility we take very seriously.
You did some reporting yourself, and then you went to do some Facebook Live reporting, my understanding is, and first of all, describe what happened with your particular incident.
Yeah. So there was a nonviolent direct action plan for Wednesday afternoon, wherein some of the water protectors were going to cross a small river to hold a prayer circle on their sacred ground on the other side. And in doing so, we're met with a full line of militarized police armed with assault rifles, with cans of pepper spray, the baton.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so there was a nonviolent drug action plan. They crossed. And I was on the near shore recording, interviewing a man, asking him what was going on, very simply. And when all of a sudden I felt a devastating blow to my lower back, whipped my head around and saw that there were two police boats very, very close to the shore right there, and one had fired a rubber bullet. Now, I cannot be more clear in saying this was a 100% nonviolent action. There was no aggression. There was no provocation. There were no words exchanged between the police and those of us on the near bank. It was the bank to which they were asking the water protectors to retreat, despite the fact that this is all Army Corps of Engineer public land. And I doubled over in pain. Josh was right there with the camera, as was Jordan from the Young Turks. It was a very startling moment to realize that I had just been shot by the police. But this is not about me. Yes, they shot a innocent female white reporter. That fact is not lost on me. But the bravery of the water protectors, the power of the nonviolent action, the people literally putting their lives on the line to defend the sacred, to defend our future, to protect our climate, is inspiring.
Well, how did you get shot? Did they just open fire on people, or did, I guess, did you provoke it? How in the world did you get shot, I guess?
No, I did not provoke it. I received quite a lot of pushback across social media. Josh posted some clips, and I posted stills from him and spoke about the incident because I knew that it was going to get out. And people said, well, clearly you were violent. Clearly you did something to ask for it. If you were a half-decent reporter, you'd have proof. And I, the next morning, was going through a video on my phone and realized that, I mean, I watched myself be shot live on camera, which is an experience I would wish on no one. I went into hysterics. I inadvertently filmed myself when the police fired at me with a rubber bullet. And that was something I chose to put out, not to call any more attention to myself, but to just highlight this indiscriminate use of excessive force.
But you realize you are a part of the story now, right?
Oh, I do. I fully realize that I'm a part of the story. And now the police are categorically denying I was shot on multiple accounts. Different media has reached out. The lieutenant, the sheriff, the press department, the release all say that I was not, which isn't a problem in and of itself. If you have fully militarized armed police firing rubber bullets out of grenade launchers that they don't even know have been dispensed. Rubber bullets, for every 90 rubber bullets fired, 2 people end up dead. 18 are permanently maimed and 44 are require hospital treatment. So they call this less lethal force, which I find highly ironic. But it was the only bullet, mace, pepper spray of any sort fired on our bank. There was one other boy, a young boy, who was shot at closer range without wearing a puffy jacket. He's in a bad way. It's dangerous. There is absolutely no cause for any such violence, any such hostile response to this peaceful, prayerful people. I am grateful that no one has been killed, that this hasn't escalated. I'm grateful no one was arrested after the 141 brutal arrests of last week. But I will do everything I can to use my voice to shine light on this, because what is happening there is horrific. It's traumatic. It's traumatic for me, but I don't have the historic trauma that's compounded on top of that. And I really hope that people continue to pressure our leaders, our president, our Department of Justice, our Army Corps of Engineers, and the government of North Dakota to stop this pipeline. Not just to reroute it, but to stop it from being put in the ground altogether.
So, well, first of all, Brandon Lee, Bruce Lee's son, he died from a rubber bullet. He took one to the abdomen during the filming of The Crow. So, yeah, there is actually even a pop culture history to deaths and rubber bullets. Wanted to transition to kind of the bigger picture here, in my opinion, is the public officials. Describe to me your relationship with the public officials and what's been going on there, even from before or after the shooting.
I've had absolutely no exchange with the police. I went there knowing that there was a presence of law enforcement who, in my opinion, are there to protect. That was clearly not the case. The first time I saw any law enforcement was there on the other shore, pepper spraying and macing my brothers and sisters, pepper spraying, macing these brave water protectors. I did not exchange a word with them. I was never in close proximity to them. And then these officers fired at me from a boat. I did not have any exchange. They didn't acknowledge the fact that they had just hit me. They stayed in their boats until their boats left. I have not spoken with the man who fired the bullet. I have filed a report with the Morton County Sheriff. I've spoken with the ACLU, with the lawyer collective there at Standing Rock. I was treated by medics and doctor. I have signed statements. And I have dozens of eyewitnesses, people who photographed and videotaped immediately after, and in addition, of course, to my inadvertent taping of the incident.
Do you have another minute or two?
Yeah, just about a minute, and then I gotta run. Yeah.
Okay, great, and good. I'm glad, and good luck to you out there. Question, just kind of wrap it up a little bit. Describe what's going on out there. I mean, I'm going to be interviewing somebody that they actually have like a school set up out there where they're actually educating kids out there, and that tells me they're in this thing for the long haul. What are you experiencing, yeah, and what are you seeing for just kind of the culture out there right now?
The people here are recognizing that this is a fight that is going to endure for probably months, if not longer, to come. They're winterizing the camps right now. People want to know what they can do. That's a desperate need that gets to, you know, well below zero, and the winds are whipping, and these people are mostly living right now in just tents or teepees that are not the sort of winter-ready types. And right now, DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, is dangerously close to the edge of the Missouri River, and that's the threat of contamination of this watershed for 17 million people. They need a permit in order to be able to drill under the river, and that is something that the Army Corps of Engineers can't not provide, and that's why we need this pressure. But I've spoken to so many who are not holding their breath, but they know that it's going to be a fight. They know that, you know, the lack of respect throughout history of Native American lands, the sovereignty of treaties, is, you know, there's a legacy of that today. So it's beautiful, though, to see all of these families. It's not just, people think that it's, you know, young men out there on the front lines. It's elders, it's children, it's families. It's people that are there creating community. There are fires and drum circles and kitchens. It is a powerful movement. It is a prayerful movement. I've learned so much about connecting to the spirit, to the creator, to the earth. There, they host sweat lodges. We were in the middle of a beautiful ceremony yesterday. So I maintain hope, because these people maintain hope, that many watch on me, water is life, and this is the only way forward.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And here's to the sound of one hand clapping, and here's to not letting this moment pass. And here's to carrying the weight of the world, and here's to screaming, yeah, never being heard, and here's to not letting this moment pass.
My name is Otis, and I am the host of the Kids in Capitalism KidCast. Let me tell you about one of our sponsors. Hatch Realty is in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Call Eric Hatch or anyone on the Hatch Realty team with any real estate question. They want to be a resource and connection for you. That's Hatch Realty, 701-212-1572. That's 701-212-1572. Hatch Realty, in the business of helping people. They just happen to sell real estate. Hatch Realty, tell them Otis sent you.
Since 1979, MBI Energy Services has committed to responsibly growing with today's oil and gas industry by providing proven experience, strategic locations, and integrated services. MBI Energy Services is well established, and its innovation in safety and excellent customer service is what truly makes MBI Energy Services the oil field service professionals. MBI Energy Services, the cutting edge in oil field safety solutions. Learn more at MBIEnergyServices.com.
Oil and gas industry is coming back, and you need a source to keep up to date on the industry. Check out Oil Man, the magazine for leaders in the American energy industry. Each issue gives you a competitive edge with the latest oil and gas news. In addition to the news and analysis, the Oil Man brings you exciting features, publishes photos from yesteryear that chronicle the history of the oil and gas industry. Visit oilman.com to learn more and subscribe today. That's theoilman.com.